For the sorceress of my party, dreaming, has not only opened the doors of other perceivable worlds, but prepared us for entering into those realms in full awareness. The second attention has endless treasures to be discovered. The initial position in which the dreamer places his body is of key importance. The old sorcerers used to call this the twin positions. The initial position in which a dreamer holds his physical body to begin dreaming is mirrored by the position in which he holds his energy body in dreams to fixate his assemblage point on any spot of his choosing. The two positions make a unit. The position in which one places the body is of utmost importance. Start your dreaming by lying on your right side with your knees a bit bent. The discipline is to maintain that position and fall asleep in it. In dreaming, then, the exercise is to dream that you lie down in exactly the same position and fall asleep again. It makes the assemblage point stay put, and I mean really stay put, in whatever position it is at the instant of that second falling asleep. The result of this exercise is total perception. The four variations of the exercise are to fall asleep lying on the right side, the left, the back, and the stomach. Then in dreaming, the exercise is to dream of falling asleep a second time in the same position as the dreaming had been started. I came from a line of sorcerers who knew how to move about in the second attention by projecting their intent. They practiced the art of projecting their thoughts in dreaming in order to accomplish the truthful reproduction of any object or structure or landmark or scenery of their choice. The sorcerers of my line used to start by gazing at a simple object and memorizing every detail of it. They would then close their eyes and visualize the object and correct their visualization against the true object until they could see it in its completeness with their eyes shut. The next thing in their developing scheme was to dream with the object and create in the dream, from the point of view of their own perception, a total materialization of the object. This act is called the first step to total perception. From a simple object, those sorcerers went on to make more and more complex items. Their final aim was for all of them together to visualize a total world, then dream that world, and thus recreate a total, veritable realm where they could exist. When any of the sorcerers of my line were able to do that, they could easily pull anyone into their intent, into their dream. Whole populations disappeared dreaming like that. It's possible because they visualized and then recreated in dreaming the same scenery. To cross the fourth gate and travel to places that exist only in someone else's intent is perilous, since every item in such a dream has to be an ultimately personal item. The essence of my explanation is that if you were, for instance, dreaming of your hometown and your dream had started when you lay down on your right side, you could very easily stay in the town of your dream. If you would lie on your right side in the dream and dream that you had fallen asleep, the second dream not only would necessarily be a dream of your hometown, but would be the most concrete dream one can imagine. The only way to have absolute control of dreams is to use the technique of the twin positions. And don't ask me why, it just happens, like everything else. The thought of evil cannot withstand examination. In the universe, only energy exists. Evil is merely a concatenation of the human mind, overwhelmed by the fixation of the assemblage point on its habitual position. Logically, there is really nothing to be afraid of. There is no past or future in the universe. There is only the moment. Think for a moment. In the universe, there is only energy, and energy has only a here and now, an endless and ever-present here and now. The secret of the twin positions is that the second dream is intending in the second attention, the only way to cross the fourth gate of dreaming. To make a dream an all-inclusive reality is the art of the old sorcerers. This is dreaming. You should know by now that its transactions are final. You have been given an abstract gift, the possibility of flying on the wings of intent. I suggest that you gather a collection of the memorable events of your life. The shamans of ancient Mexico conceived of the collection of memorable events as a bona fide device to stir caches of energy that exist within the self. They explain these caches as being composed of energy that originates in the body itself and becomes displaced, pushed out of reach by the circumstances of our daily lives. In this sense, the collection of memorable events is the means for redeploying our unused energy. The prerequisite for this collection is the genuine and all-consuming act of putting together the sum total of one's emotions and realizations without sparing anything. The shamans of our lineage were convinced that the collection of memorable events was the vehicle for the emotional and energetic adjustment necessary for venturing, in terms of perception, into the unknown. The total goal of the shamanistic knowledge that we are handling is the preparation for facing the definitive journey, the journey that every human being has to take at the end of his life. Through their discipline and resolve, shamans are capable of retaining their individual awareness and purpose after death. For them, the vague, idealistic state that modern man calls life after death is a concrete region filled to capacity with practical affairs of a different order than the practical affairs of daily life, yet bearing a similar functional practicality. To collect the memorable events in their lives is, for shamans, the preparation for their entrance into that concrete region which they call the active side of infinity. Every warrior, as a matter of duty, collects an album that reveals the warrior's personality, an album that attests to the circumstances of his life. Above all, it is like an album of pictures made out of memories, the recollection of memorable events, memorable because they have a special significance in one's life. Put in it the complete account of various events that have had profound significance for you. Not every event has a profound significance for you. There are a few, however, that I would consider likely to have changed things for you, to have illuminated your path. Ordinarily, events that change our path are impersonal affairs, and yet are extremely personal. Don't think about this album in terms of banalities or in terms of a trivial rehashing of your life experiences. Every one of us human beings has two minds. One is totally ours, and it is like a faint voice that always brings us order, directness, purpose. The other mind is a foreign installation. It brings us conflict, self-assertion, doubts, hopelessness. It's ourselves as the me center of the world. Let's put the topic of our two minds aside and go back to the idea of preparing your album of memorable events. Such an album is an exercise in discipline and impartiality. Consider this album to be an act of war. As such, it has all the meaning in the world. We are not naturally petty and contradictory. Our pettiness and contradictions are rather the result of a transcendental conflict that afflicts every one of us, but of which only sorcerers are painfully and hopelessly aware, the conflict of our two minds. One is our true mind, the product of all our life experiences, the one that rarely speaks because it has been defeated and relegated to obscurity. The other mind, we use daily for everything we do, is a foreign installation. To resolve the conflict of the two minds is a matter of intending it. Sorcerers beckon intent by voicing the word intent loud and clear. Intent is a force that exists in the universe. When sorcerers beckon intent, it comes to them and sets up the path for attainment, which means that sorcerers always accomplish what they set out to do. Intent can be called, of course, for anything, but sorcerers have found out the hard way that intent comes to them only for something that is abstract. That's the safety valve for sorcerers. Otherwise, they would be unbearable. Beckoning intent to resolve the conflict of your two minds or to hear the voice of your true mind is not a petty or arbitrary matter. Quite the contrary. It is ethereal and abstract and yet as vital to you as anything can be. Your album, being an act of war, demands a super careful selection. It is a precise collection of the unforgettable moments of your life and everything that led you to them. Concentrate in it what has been and will be meaningful to you. A warrior's album is something most concrete, something so to the point that it is shattering. Sit down alone and let your thoughts, memories, and ideas come to you freely. Make an effort to let the voice from the depths of you speak out and tell you what to select. The selection is not an easy matter. This is the reason I say that making this album is an act of war. You have to remake yourself 10 times over in order to know what to select. Don't include stories that relate exclusively to you as the person who thinks, feels, cries, or doesn't feel anything at all. The memorable events of a shaman's album are affairs that will stand the test of time because they have nothing to do with him, and yet he is in the thick of them. He'll always be in the thick of them, for the duration of his life, and perhaps beyond, but not quite personally. In my time, not only did I not know what to choose, I thought I had no experiences to choose from. It seemed that nothing had ever happened to me. Of course, everything had happened to me, but in my effort to defend the idea of myself, I had no time or inclination to notice anything. The stories of a warrior's album are not personal, not assertions about you at the center of everything. You feel, you don't feel, you realize, you didn't realize. All of that type of story is just you. The memorable events we are after have the dark touch of the impersonal. That touch permeates them. I don't know how else to explain this. Don't explain yourself too much. Sorcerers say that in every explanation there is a hidden apology. So when you are explaining why you cannot do this or that, you're really apologizing for your shortcomings, hoping that whoever is listening to you will have the kindness to understand them. Every one of us, young and old alike, is making figures in front of a mirror in one way or another. Tally what you know about people. Think of any human being on this earth, and you will know without a shadow of a doubt that no matter who they are or what they think of themselves or what they do, the result of their actions is always the same. Senseless figures in front of a mirror. Listen to your inner voice. Don't listen to the superficial voice that makes you angry. Listen to that deeper voice that is going to guide you from now on, the voice that is laughing. Listen to it and laugh with it. Laugh. Laugh. It is the nature of infinity, once we cross a certain threshold, to put a blueprint in front of us. Don't waste your energy worrying about things. Everyone is locked in a vicious cycle. We all have our magic cure, which we trust will cure everything and resolve every one of our problems. At the moment, perhaps we can't afford it, but we have great hopes that we eventually will be able to. Sorcerers' aspirations are to reach infinity and to be conscious of it. The task of sorcerers is to face infinity. They plunge into it daily, as a fisherman plunges into the sea. It is such an overwhelming task that sorcerers have to state their names before venturing into it. In this manner, they assert their individuality in front of the infinite. What makes human beings into sorcerers is their capacity to perceive energy directly as it flows in the universe. Human beings are not only capable of seeing energy directly as it flows in the universe, but they actually do see it, although they are not deliberately conscious of seeing it. Awareness is energy, and energy is constant flux, a luminous vibration that is never stationary, but always moving of its own accord. The novel Elias and the novel Julian were astoundingly alike in that there was nothing inside them. They were empty. The novel Elias was a collection of astounding, haunting stories of regions unknown. The novel Julian was a collection of stories that would have anybody in stitches, sprawling on the ground laughing. Whenever I tried to pin down the man in them, the real man, the way I could pin down the man in my father, the man in everybody I knew, I found nothing. Instead of a real person inside them, there was a bunch of stories about persons unknown. Each of the two men had his own flair, but the end result was just the same. Emptiness. An emptiness that reflected not the world, but infinity. The moment one crosses a peculiar threshold in infinity, either deliberately or unwittingly, everything that happens to one from then on is no longer exclusively in one's own domain, but enters into the realm of infinity. Infinity is everything that surrounds us, the spirit, the dark sea of awareness. It is something that exists out there and rules our lives. My steps and yours are guided by infinity. The circumstances that seem to be ruled by chance are in essence ruled by the active side of infinity, intent. What put you and me together was the active side of infinity. It is impossible to determine what this intent of infinity is, yet it is there, as palpable as you and I are. Sorcerers say that it is a tremor in the air. The advantage of sorcerers is to know that the tremor in the air exists and to acquiesce to it without any further ado. For sorcerers, there is no pondering, wondering, or speculating. They know that all they have is the possibility of merging with the intent of infinity, and they just do it. A novel is empty. That emptiness doesn't reflect the world. It reflects infinity. A novel has no boisterousness on his part, or assertions about the self. There is not a speck of a need to have either grievances or remorse. His is the emptiness of a warrior traveler, seasoned to the point where he doesn't take anything for granted. A warrior traveler who doesn't underestimate or overestimate anything. A quiet, disciplined fighter whose elegance is so extreme that no one, no matter how hard they try to look, will ever find the seam where all that complexity has come together. What's happening to you is the workings of infinity. Your sensation of nervousness is due to the subliminal realization that your time is up. You are aware of it, but not deliberately conscious of it. You feel the absence of time, and that makes you impatient. I know this, for it happened to me and to all the sorcerers of my lineage. At a given time, a whole era in my life, or their lives, ended. Now it's your turn. You have simply run out of time. Your malady is a very simple one. Your world is coming to an end. It is the end of an era for you. Do you think that the world you have known all your life is going to leave you peacefully, without any fuss or muss? No, it will wriggle underneath you and hit you with its tail. But an era doesn't really come to an end until the king dies. You are the king. Every one of us has an energetic fissure, an energetic crack below the navel. That crack, which sorcerers call the gap, is closed when a man is in his prime. Normally, all that is discernible to the sorcerer's eye is a tenuous discoloration in the otherwise whitish glow of the luminous sphere. But when a man is close to dying, that gap becomes quite apparent. I once saw a man's gap that was wide open. The significance was a deadly one. The spirit was signaling to me that something was coming to an end. I thought it was my life that was coming to an end, and I accepted it as gracefully as I could. It dawned on me much, much later that it wasn't my life that was coming to an end, but my entire lineage. You bypass things like this. It's youth. So many things to do, so many people around you. You're not alert. You never learned to be alert anyway. To be alert doesn't mean to be watchful. For sorcerers, to be alert means to be aware of the fabric of the everyday world that seems extraneous to the interaction of the moment. Don't hide yourself behind banalities. Stand up. Assume responsibility for what you know. Don't get lost in the extraneous fabric of the world around you, extraneous to what's going on. Don't be so concerned with yourself and your problems. Watch the scenery around us, the mountains in the distance, or the riverbed, or the desert. Sorcerers do that, and then nothing counts except what their eyes can absorb. In this way, they unburden themselves of everything superfluous. Sorcerers never say things idly. I am most careful about what I say to you or to anybody else. The difference between you and me is that I don't have any time at all, and I act accordingly. You, on the other hand, believe that you have all the time in the world, and you act accordingly. The end result of our individual behaviors is that I measure everything I do and say, and you don't. You're looking for a sorcerer's medication to remove everything annoying from you, with no effort at all on your part. You want results, one potion and you're cured. Sorcerers face things in a different way. Since they don't have any time to spare, they give themselves fully to what's in front of them. Your turmoil is the result of your lack of sobriety. As for your friend, you didn't have the sobriety to thank him properly. That happens to every one of us. We never express what we feel, and when we want to, it's too late because we have run out of time. It's not only your friend who ran out of time, you too ran out of it. But the moment when you should have thanked him, you were angry with him. You were judging him. He was nasty to you, whatever. And then you postponed seeing him. In reality, what you did was to postpone thanking him. Now you're stuck with a ghost on your tail. You'll never be able to pay what you owe him. Your friend knew that he was dying. Now you say that the weight of my words is too much for your shoulders, that you want to leave, to be in the city and get lost in its noise. You are having a taste of infinity. I know it because I have been in your shoes. You want to run away, to plunge into something human, warm, contradictory, stupid. Who cares? You want to forget the death of your friend, but infinity won't let you. It has gripped you in its merciless clutches. The only thing you can do is to keep the memory of your friend fresh, to keep it alive for the rest of your life and perhaps even beyond. Sorcerers express in this fashion the thanks that they can no longer voice. You may think it is a silly way, but that's the best sorcerers can do. Sadness for sorcerers is not personal. It is not quite sadness. It's a wave of energy that comes from the depths of the cosmos and hits sorcerers when they are receptive, when they are like radios, capable of catching radio waves. The sorcerers of olden times who gave us the entire format of sorcery believed that there is a sadness in the universe as a force, a condition, like light, like intent, and that this perennial force acts especially on sorcerers because they no longer have any defensive shields. They cannot hide behind their friends or their studies. They cannot hide behind love or hatred or happiness or misery. They can't hide behind anything. The condition of sorcerers is that sadness for them is abstract. It doesn't come from coveting or lacking something or from self-importance. It doesn't come from me. It comes from infinity. The sadness you feel for not thanking your friend is already leaning in that direction. Inner silence is a peculiar state of being in which thoughts are cancelled out and one can function from a level other than that of daily awareness. Inner silence means the suspension of the internal dialogue, the perennial companion of thought, and is therefore a state of profound quietude. The old sorcerers called it inner silence because it is a state in which perception doesn't depend on the senses. What is at work during inner silence is another faculty that man has, the faculty that makes him a magical being, the very faculty that has been curtailed, not by him himself, but by some extraneous influence. Inner silence is the stand from which everything stems in sorcery. In other words, everything we do leads to that stand, which, like everything else in the world of sorcerers, doesn't reveal itself unless something gigantic shakes us. The sorcerers of ancient Mexico devised endless ways to shake themselves or other sorcery practitioners at their foundations in order to reach that coveted state of inner silence. They considered the most far-fetched acts, which may seem totally unrelated to the pursuit of inner silence, such as, for instance, jumping into waterfalls or spending nights hanging upside down from the top branch of a tree, to be the key points that brought it into being. Inner silence is accrued, accumulated. I have guided you to construct a core of inner silence in yourself, and then add to it, second by second, on every occasion you practice it. The sorcerers of ancient Mexico discovered that each individual has a different threshold of inner silence in terms of time, meaning that inner silence must be kept by each one of us for the length of time of our specific threshold before it can work. Inner silence works from the moment you begin to accrue it. What the old sorcerers were after was the final, dramatic end result of reaching that individual threshold of silence. Some very talented practitioners need only a few minutes of silence to reach that coveted goal. Others, less talented, need long periods of silence, perhaps more than an hour of complete quietude before they reach the desired result. The desired result is what the old sorcerers called stopping the world, the moment when everything around us ceases to be what it's always been. This is the moment when sorcerers return to the true nature of man. The old sorcerers also called it total freedom. It is the moment when man the slave becomes man the free being, capable of feats of perception that defy our linear imagination. Inner silence is the avenue that leads to a true suspension of judgment, to a moment when sensory data emanation from the universe at large ceases to be interpreted by the senses, a moment when cognition ceases to be the force which, through usage and repetition, decides the nature of the world. Sorcerers need a breaking point for the workings of inner silence to set in. The breaking point is like the mortar that a mason puts between bricks. It's only when the mortar hardens that the loose bricks become a structure. From the beginning of our association, I have drilled into you the value, the necessity of inner silence. You must do your best to follow my suggestions by accumulating inner silence second by second. You have no means to measure the effect of this accumulation, nor do you have any means to judge whether or not you have reached any threshold. Simply aim doggedly at accruing it. The act of accumulating it is a challenge in itself. Every sorcerer I know, male or female, sooner or later arrives at a breaking point in their lives. Not a mental breakdown or anything like that. Mental breakdowns are for persons who indulge in themselves. What I mean is that at a given moment, the continuity of their lives has to break in order for inner silence to set in and become an active part of their structures. It's very, very important that you yourself deliberately arrive at that breaking point, or that you create it artificially and intelligently. Your breaking point is to discontinue your life as you know it. You have done everything I've told you dutifully and accurately. If you are talented, you never show it. That seems to be your style. You're not slow, but you act as if you were. You're very sure of yourself, but you act as if you were insecure. You're not timid, and yet you act as if you were afraid of people. Everything you do points at one single spot. You need to break all that ruthlessly. I think everything boils down to one act. You must leave your friends. You must say goodbye to them for good. It's not possible for you to continue on the warrior's path carrying your personal history with you, and unless you discontinue your way of life, I won't be able to go ahead with my instruction. Your friends and your family, they are your points of reference. Therefore, they have to go. Sorcerers have only one point of reference, infinity. You must simply leave. Leave any way you can. You have never been alone in your life. This is the time to do it. I don't want your body to die physically. I want your person to die. The two are very different affairs. In essence, your person has very little to do with your body. Your person is your mind, and believe you me, your mind is not yours. I'll tell you about that subject someday, but not while you're cushioned by your friends. The criterion that indicates that a sorcerer is dead is when it makes no difference to him whether he has company or whether he is alone. The day you don't covet the company of your friends, whom you use as shields, that's the day that your person has died. I ran away from the sorcerer's world once, and I had to nearly die to realize my stupidity. The important issue is to arrive at a breaking point, in whatever way, so that inner silence will become real for you. You have no time to lose. For infinity, the only worthwhile enterprise of a warrior is freedom. Any other enterprise is fraudulent. The end of an era is an accurate description of a process that shamans go through in dismantling the structure of the world they know in order to replace it with another way of understanding the world around them. I've endeavored from the very instant we met to introduce you to the cognitive world of the shamans of ancient Mexico. The world of the sorcerers of ancient Mexico is different from ours. not in a shallow way, but different in the way in which the process of a cognition is arranged. In our world, our cognition requires the interpretation of sensory data. The universe is composed of an infinite number of energy fields that exist in the universe at large as luminous filaments. Those luminous filaments act on man as an organism. The response of the organism is to turn those energy fields into sensory data. Sensory data is then interpreted, and that interpretation becomes our cognitive system. The end of an era means that the units of a foreign cognition are beginning to take hold. The units of your normal cognition, no matter how pleasant and rewarding they are for you, are beginning to fade. A grave moment in the life of a man. Don't admire people from afar. That is the surest way to create mythological beings. Get close to them, talk to them, see what they are like as people, test them. If their behavior is the result of their conviction that they are a being who is going to die, then everything they do, no matter how strange, must be premeditated and final. If what they say turns out to be just words, they're not worth a hoot. Human beings are beings that are going to die. Sorcerers firmly maintain that the only way to have a grip on our world and on what we do in it is by fully accepting that we are beings on the way to dying. Without this basic acceptance, our lives, our doings, and the world in which we live are unmanageable affairs. The acceptance of this is far-reaching. However, it's not the mere acceptance that does the trick. We have to embody that acceptance and live it all the way through. Sorcerers throughout the ages have said that the view of our death is the most sobering view that exists. What is wrong with us human beings, and has been wrong since time immemorial, is that without ever stating it in so many words, we believe that we have entered the realm of immortality. We behave as if we were never going to die. An infantile arrogance. But even more injurious than this sense of immortality is what comes with it, the sense that we can engulf this inconceivable universe with our minds. Sorcerers don't admire people in a vacuum. They talk to them. They get to know them. They establish points of reference. They compare. Sorcerers view any kind of activity with people, no matter how minute or unimportant, as a battlefield. In that battlefield, sorcerers perform their best magic, their best effort. The trick to being at ease in such situations is to face our opponents openly. Abhorrent are the timid souls who shy away from interaction to the point where even though they interact, they merely infer or deduce in terms of their own psychological states what is going on without actually perceiving what is really going on. They interact without ever being part of the interaction. Always look at the man who is involved in a tug of war with you. Don't just pull the rope. Look up and see his eyes. You'll know then that he is a man just like you, no matter what he's saying, no matter what he's doing. He's shaking in his boots just like you. A look like that renders the opponent helpless, if only for an instant. Deliver your blow then. When the sorcerers talk about the cognitive world of ancient Mexico, they are talking about things for which we have no equivalent in the world of everyday life. For instance, perceiving energy directly as it flows in the universe is a unit of cognition that shamans live by. They see how energy flows, and they follow its flow. If its flow is obstructed, they move away to do something entirely different. Shamans see lines in the universe. Their art, or their job, is to choose the line that will take them, perception-wise, to regions that have no name. You can say that shamans react immediately to the lines of the universe. They see human beings as luminous balls, and they search in them for their flow of energy. Naturally, they react instantly to this sight. It's part of their cognition. The practicalities that scientists are interested in are conducive to building more and more complex machines. They are not the practicalities that changed an individual's life course from within. They are not geared to reaching the vastness of the universe as a personal, experiential affair. The stupendous machines in existence, or those in the making, are cultural affairs, the attainment of which has to be enjoyed vicariously, even by the creators of those machines themselves. The only reward for them is monetary. Perhaps you can recall what I said to you about one of our biggest flaws as average human beings. The big flaw I'm talking about is something you ought to bear in mind every second of your existence. For me, it's the issue of issues, which I will repeat to you over and over until it comes out your ears. We are beings on our way to dying. We are not immortal, but we behave as if we were. This is the flaw that brings us down as individuals and will bring us down as a species someday. The sorcerer's advantage over their average fellow men is that sorcerers know that they are beings on their way to dying, and they don't let themselves deviate from that knowledge. An enormous effort must be employed in order to elicit and maintain this knowledge as a total certainty. Why is it so hard for us to admit something that is so truthful? It's really not man's fault. Someday, I'll tell you more about the forces that drive a man to act like an ass. Many of us make sense when we talk because we are prepared to use words accurately, but most of us are not prepared to take ourselves seriously as men who are going to die. Being immortal, we wouldn't know how to do that. It makes no difference what complex machines scientists can build. The machines can in no way help anyone face the unavoidable appointment, the appointment with infinity. The novel Julian used to tell me about the conquering generals of ancient Rome. When they would return home victorious, gigantic parades were staged to honor them. Riding with them was always a slave whose job was to whisper in their ear that all fame and glory is but transitory. If we are victorious in any way, we don't have anyone to whisper in our ear that our victories are fleeting. Sorcerers, however, do have the upper hand. As beings on their way to dying, they have someone whispering in their ear that everything is ephemeral. The whisperer is death, the infallible advisor, the only one who won't ever tell you a lie. Warrior travelers, don't leave any debts unpaid. It is time that you square certain indebtedness you have incurred in the course of your life. Not that you will ever pay in full, mind you, but you must make a gesture. You must make a token payment in order to atone, in order to appease infinity. What you intend to do is something very simple and yet nearly impossible. You want to cross over the threshold of personal indebtedness and in one sweep be free in order to proceed. If you cannot cross that threshold, there won't be any point in trying to continue with me. I have told you over and over that warrior travelers are pragmatists. They are not involved in sentimentalism or nostalgia or melancholy. For warrior travelers, there is only struggle, and it is a struggle with no end. If you think that you have come here to find peace, or that this is a lull in your life, you're wrong. This task of paying your debts is not guided by any feelings that you know about. It is guided by the purest sentiment, the sentiment of a warrior traveler who is about to dive into infinity, and just before he does, he turns around to say thank you to those who favored him. You must face this task with all the gravity it deserves. It is your last stop before infinity swallows you. In fact, unless a warrior traveler is in a sublime state of being, infinity will not touch him with a 10-foot pole. So don't spare yourself. Don't spare any effort. Push it mercilessly, but elegantly, all the way through. If you don't have self-importance, you have only feelings. Do the following simple and direct exercise that could mean the world to you. Remove from your memory of a past interaction with someone any statement that you made to yourself, such as, he said this or that to me, or he yelled at me, and remain at the level of your feelings. If you hadn't been so self-important, what would you have had as the irreducible residue at that level of your feelings? And is that feeling any less today than it was? Now embrace them from your silence. Don't be meager. Embrace them totally for the last time. But intend that this is the last time on earth. Intend it from your darkness. If you are worth your salt, when you make your gift to them, you will sum up your entire life. Acts of this nature make warriors airborne, almost vaporous. What we usually feel is merely the result of indulging in self-pity. In order to say goodbye and thank you and really mean it and sustain it, sorcerers have to remake themselves. Vanquish your self-pity right now. Vanquish the idea that you are hurt, and what you have as an irreducible residue is your feelings, not in the spirit of renewing anything or harming anyone, including yourself, but in the spirit of a warrior traveler whose only virtue is to keep alive the memory of whatever has affected him, whose only way to say thank you and goodbye is by this act of magic, of storing in his silence whatever he has loved. Don't indulge in being fatigued. Your fatigue is, more than fatigue, a desire not to be bothered. Something in you resents being bothered. But it's most important that you exacerbate that part of you until it breaks down. There is an enormous premium on time. For sorcerers in general, time is of the essence. The challenge I am faced with is that in a very compact unit of time, I must cram into you everything there is to know about sorcery as an abstract proposition. But in order to do that, I have to build the necessary space in you. The premise of sorcerers is that in order to bring something in, there must be a space to put it in. If you are filled to the brim with the items of everyday life, there's no space for anything new. That space must be built. Do you see what I mean? The sorcerers of olden times believed that the recapitulation of your life made the space. It does, and much more, of course. The way sorcerers perform the recapitulation is very formal. It consists of writing a list of all the people they have met, from the present to the very beginning of their lives. Once they have that list, they take the first person on it and recollect everything they can about that person. And I mean everything, every detail. It's better to recapitulate from the present to the past because the memories of the present are fresh, and in this manner the recollection ability is honed. What practitioners do is to recollect and breathe. They inhale slowly and deliberately, fanning the head from right to left in a barely noticeable swing, and exhale in the same fashion. The inhalations and exhalations should be natural. If they are too rapid, one enters into something called tiring breaths. Breaths that require slower breathing afterward in order to calm down the muscles. Begin making your list today. Divide it by years, by occupations. Arrange it in any order you want, but make it sequential with the most recent person first and end with Mommy and Daddy. And then remember everything about them. No more ado than that. As you practice, you will realize what you're doing. I am sure that you have bouts with intent. You intended something, and anything that was opposed to it, you had to let go. The touch of warrior travelers is very light, although it is cultivated. The hand of a warrior traveler begins as a heavy, gripping iron hand, but becomes like the hand of a ghost, a hand made of gossamer. Warrior travelers leave no marks, no tracks. That's the challenge for warrior travelers. The power of the recapitulation is that it stirs up all the garbage of our lives and brings it to the surface. I'm going to delineate the intricacies of awareness and perception, which are the basis of the recapitulation. I'm going to present an arrangement of concepts that you should not take as sorcerer's theories under any conditions, because it is an arrangement formulated by the shamans of ancient Mexico as a result of seeing energy directly as it flows in the universe. I will present the units of this arrangement to you without any attempt at classifying them or ranking them by any predetermined standard. I'm not interested in classifications. You have been classifying everything all your life. Now you are going to be forced to stay away from classifications. Classifications have a world of their own. After you begin to classify anything, the classification becomes alive and it rules you. But since classifications never started as energy-giving affairs, they always remain like dead logs. The sorcerers of ancient Mexico saw that the universe at large is composed of energy fields in the form of luminous filaments. They saw zillions of them. Wherever they turned to see, They also saw that those energy fields arranged themselves into currents of luminous fibers, streams that are constant, perennial forces in the universe. The current or stream of filaments that is related to the recapitulation was named by those sorcerers the Dark Sea of Awareness, and also the Eagle. Those sorcerers also found out that every creature in the universe is attached to the Dark Sea of Awareness at a round point of luminosity that was apparent when those creatures were perceived as energy. On that point of luminosity, which the sorcerers of ancient Mexico called the assemblage point of human beings, zillions of energy fields from the universe at large in the form of luminous filaments converge and go through it. These energy fields are converted into sensory data, and the sensory data is then interpreted and perceived as the world we know. What turns the luminous fibers into sensory data is the Dark Sea of Awareness. Sorcerers see this transformation and call it the glow of awareness, a sheen that extends like a halo around the assemblage point. I'm going to make a statement which, in the understanding of sorcerers, is central to comprehending the scope of the recapitulation. What we call the senses in organisms is nothing but degrees of awareness. If we accept that the senses are the Dark Sea of Awareness, we have to admit that the interpretation that the senses make of sensory data is also the Dark Sea of Awareness. To face the world around us in the terms that we do is the result of the interpretation system of mankind with which every human being is equipped. Every organism in existence has to have an interpretation system that permits it to function in its surroundings.